of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see. Who knows? I felt it from the first embrace I shared with you.
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach. And this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 56 here at the New Republic. Grierson, do you have a case of Oscar fever?
It's a very mild case. I'm taking ibuprofen at the moment, so I think I'm going to kind of like nip it in the bud. How about you?
If you don't stop scratching, it's never going to heal. That's what I'm going to tell you about. Not only Oscar fever, but pretty much all maladies. Don't scratch them. They'll only get infected. So this week, we are going to, it's our Oscar preview show. The Oscars are very soon. They are Sunday, February 28th. That's right, right, Grierson? February 27th. 26th. There we go. 7 days. Sunday, February 26th is Oscar night in all of its glory. So this is going to be not entirely an Oscar show, but what we were going to do is we are going to preview the Oscars. We're going to do this for two ways. One, we're going to help you with your Oscar pools because everybody's got the Oscar pool. Gambling is, you know, I used to give all of these things about how gambling is illegal. We do not endorse any gambling thing, but freaking even the sports leagues are okay with gambling now. I think you and I, Grierson, are the only two people in the world that don't gamble.
Yeah, I'm a bad gambler. I think that's part of it. Like, I have no confidence in my gambling skills. So our track record for the Oscars is not bad, though, I will say. We do okay, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, so if you have a pool, this is your chance. Because what we're going to do is we're going to go through every category. Now, we're not going to give you long breakdowns of the documentary shorts because I frankly haven't seen any of those movies, but we will be making predictions on each one for your Oscar pool. And then when we get to the final eight, the big eight, such as they were, we will make our predictions there. And then we'll also tell you the one that we think maybe should be on there. We also encourage you to go to the New Republic, where a lot of this stuff will be in written form in case you're like, these guys go on too long. I'll just read it real fast. Cause you know, and you can also be like nostalgic back in the days when people read long things online.
Yeah, print matters, for crying out loud. I'm just imagining someone who's listened to 56 of these episodes and gone, you know, maybe I'll just read them this time.
Maybe I'll just read them this time. That's enough. That's enough.
That's enough talky talk out of you two.
Enough lippy, Grierson and Leachy. All right, we are also, in addition, going to talk about the new movie, The Great Wall, in this section. We also, of course, remind you for our reboot section, we have a reboot movie this week. We remind you, as always, to please subscribe to us on iTunes, give us a nice review. Find us on SoundCloud, on thenewrepublic.com, at Grierson Leach, at Twitter, at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH. Of course, email us, GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com. I respond to all of those emails. Forgive me, there's a few in the box right now that I have not gotten back to you. I promise I get back to every email anyone ever writes me ever. It is an affliction, but it is true. But I've not gotten back to some people in there, don't worry. We've seen your emails. We'll get back to you. Please keep emailing us, GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com. But first, we have to get to our reboot movie. Remind you, as always, give us a review on iTunes with the name of a movie you would like us to talk about, and we will review it in our reboot section. This week, our reboot movie comes to us from MZ10001. Great banter and insight, says MZ10001. Humorous and self-aware, the show is everything you'd want in a podcast about movies! ! Then, being efficient, says simply in parentheses, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I assume that's not just something that MZ1001 was saying, was in fact making a request for our reboot section, so it is my honor to oblige that request. This week, we will be discussing Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Excuse me. Molaram Sudram. So, Grierson, first off, we need to talk Oscars. The first thing I want to talk to you about Oscars, we wrote a piece, before we get into our predictions, we wrote a piece a few years ago for Deadspin after the infamous Seth MacFarlane hosting. And basically talking about what makes a good host, what works, what doesn't. This year, there's a new host. There's Jimmy Kimmel, which I think that at the very least we can all say he is, in fact, the most tolerable of the late night Jimmys.
It's a hot take, but yes, I stand behind that.
I think I feel fair about that as well. And frankly, the one that is increasingly in better shape, actually. But we'll talk. That's a whole other discussion. But so he is hosting this year. Makes sense. He's the ABC guy. Surprising he's actually frankly taken this long. I'm curious, Grierson, when you are looking for an Oscar host, and you kind of answered my second question with this, what are you looking for from an Oscar host? What's the hang-ups of the job, the most difficult parts of it, and who's like been your favorite host? Is that maybe a good example of someone that did that right?
I have to say that nowadays, the thing I look most forward to an Oscar host is a host who I have very low expectations for, which sounds incredibly snotty, I realize, but I look at Neil Patrick Harris as somebody who was sort of served up on a silver platter, I think, for a lot of people as, oh, great, he's been so great as the host of the Tonys. We're so happy he's going to be hosting the Oscars now. And he kind of crashed and burned, honestly, as an Oscar host. I thought he was kind of smug and insufferable and just not very funny. And I think there is more of a disappointment with him because there were higher expectations. Whereas I think somebody like Ellen DeGeneres, to be honest, I think everybody thinks is, you know, perfectly fine, but not exactly an inspiring host. That person can kind of get away with having a mediocre show because you don't have much expectation. I think it was also true of Chris Rock from last year. I think people were really excited, like, oh, Chris Rock is going to eviscerate the Oscars and destroy them because of the Oscars so white controversy. And I thought it was fine, but it wasn't great. And so because of that, there's a much more of a disappointment. So I have to say that Jimmy Kimmel's sort of a perfect host because I don't watch his show very much. I think it's perfectly fine, but not really exceptional. And so he has a very low bar to get over as far as I'm concerned. I think easily, though, the best host of the last 10, 15 years, I mean, has to be Steve Martin, right?
And not Steve Martin with Alec Baldwin, but just Steve Martin.
Yeah, he does not need an appendage. He does it just fine by himself. No, I think Steve Martin walked the line perfectly of classy, sophisticated, witty, but also just sort of goofy enough. And also understanding that he's sort of a side attraction to the show itself.
But also a member of the club. Because I think there's an aspect of it, too, that whenever someone kind of comes in from the – by member of the club, I mean, like, the dude – like, the guy wrote a movie called L.A. Story. Like he is part of the movie industry and has been so for a very long time. And I think that gives him a little touch of that Bob Hope-ness that I think it helps. Whenever someone kind of comes in, like a Seth MacFarlane, who's like, I'm going to take it to these guys. I'm from the outside. This is one of the things that I actually didn't mind Letterman as a host. But one of the things that was difficult for Letterman as being the host of the show was this, oh, I'm not part of this stuff. So am I going to undermine the show? Am I going to say I'm above this stuff? Steve Martin could just go out there and be like, listen, I'm kind of the guy you'd expect to host the Oscars. So therefore, I'm part of this world, and therefore I can poke fun of this world without having to be this like, I'm rebellious, can't you stand me? Like the Ricky Gervais idea is probably the best way to think of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and also Steve Martin wrote Bowfinger, which is such a very funny, insidery Hollywood comedy. I still remember when he hosted the show, and I forget how he put it, but during his opening monologue, talked about the fact that, millions of people around the world are all watching us and all assuming we're gay. There is an idea that Steve Martin was including himself as part of that. And so I think the audience is much more receptive to the idea of, oh, he's one of us. When he makes fun of us, he's including himself in the mockery. And so, yeah.
I think Jimmy Kimmel, frankly, I think you're right. I think he seems like he'll be good at the job. He'll be fine at the job. And it's really, that's all you want. And he doesn't come in with that idea that like, The Seth MacFarlane obnoxiousness, look at me, look how daring I am. Like, Kimmel will come in and he'll poke fun at everybody. You know, he's kind of famous for doing those stand-ups at the ABC upfronts. He's kind of famous for doing like a thing where he makes fun of everybody there and makes fun of the press and makes fun of the industry and is really good at it. And while still like poking fun at everybody, but also not poking fun at them too hard, being a little political, but not too political. He seems like, for what the Oscars will be trying to do, he seems like kind of the guy for what that aim is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this year's ceremony is going to be, you know, without question, is going to be politically There's going to be a lot of political commentary, I think, from certain winners anyway. So I think somebody like Kimmel makes sense because, you know, that's not his bread and butter. We're going to see a Hollywood Oscar mean tweets. I mean, that's guaranteed. Yeah. We're going to see that. If we see anything with Matt Damon, I'll be a little more concerned, I think, because I think that shtick is kind of getting a little bit tired. But, you know, so he's a pleasant host. We're not going to see Adam Carolla, thank God. but yeah, so I this is exactly the way I want to go into an Oscars, where I'm like, oh, I'll be curious to see how he hosts. I don't care one way or the other. I have no emotional investments in how he does. So
fair enough. All right, so now it's time for your Oscar pool. Time for everyone's Oscar pool. We're going to go through. So get out your little sheet, because someone in your office has given you an Oscar pool. Here are Grierson and Leach to help you out. It's a shame, honestly, that our podcast is listened to by 7 to 8 million people every single week, because otherwise it could be like the quiet thing that only you know. So hopefully no one in your office, don't tell anyone in your office about this podcast until after you win the pool this week, and then make all of them listen to it all the time.
Yeah, that seems like an excellent marketing strategy, I think, in general for the podcast. Don't tell anybody that you listen to this podcast. It's probably
until you win the pool, and they're like, wow, Tom, Frank, Betty, how did you win that? It was the Grierson Leach podcast. So here are your guaranteed wins. We're going to start from some of these minor categories. I hate to say minor categories. These are I like to refer to them as the "you better keep your speech short" categories. And that's what these are. So we're not going to, like, I've not seen a lot of these movies. If Grierson has seen a few more of them than I have, we may have some small opinions about them, but this is the lightning round until we get to the final eight. So Grierson, are you ready?
I am ready.
We start with best live action short: Ennemis Interiors, Sing, Time Code, Silent Nights, and La Femme et la TGV. The Leach prediction here is Ennemis Interiors.
That was a lovely pronunciation, and I could do no better. That would also be my prediction in this category.
Okay, so there's your best live action short, Ennemis Interiors. Best document. Pretty good, right?
You got better the second time, I think. Yeah.
It's almost like I'm whatever country that language is spoken in.
Yes. Again, we remind you, don't tell anybody you listen to the Grierson and Leach podcast. Okay, go ahead.
All right. Next is best documentary short. The nominees are Joe's Violin, The White Helmets, 4.1 Miles, Extremis, and Watani, My Homeland. My prediction for you here in Best Documentary Short, Grierson, is Extremis.
I'm going with The White Helmets, just because, partly because the subject of the movie was not going to be able to get into the country because of Trump's Muslim ban. He now is going to be able to. I think the raised awareness about that subject matter is going to help it win.
Fair enough. Grierson made a good enough case. Go with him. Next is Best Animated Short: Blind Vaisha, Borrowed Time, Piper, which many of you may have seen as the Pixar short, Pear, Cider, and Cigarettes, and Pearl. Because it is a Pixar short, I find it hard to argue against Piper.
I've actually seen all five of these. I think Piper is going to win as well, though I have to confess, I've seen it twice now and can remember nothing about it both times that I've seen it. It's like so pleasant, but kind of forgettable. I still think it's going to win. I have to say, if you are curious, Pear, Cider, and Cigarettes is fantastic, and I highly recommend it.
Duly noted, Pear, Cider, and Cigarettes. So go see that, but actually pick Piper in your pool, because Piper, at the very least, Piper is not about volcanoes. So it has that going for it. All right, now we go to Best Foreign Language Film. The nominees are A Man Called Ove, or Ove, or Over, or Ove, A Man Called Ove, The Salesman, Land of Mine, Tony Erdmann, and Tana. This is a tough one. I would have assumed it was going to be Tony Erdmann, but I think certainly the way the politics have gone over the last month, I think that will help The Salesman. I think that's enough to push it for me to predict The Salesman.
I agree completely. I thought Tony Erdmann was going to be the easy favorites. I think The Salesman is going to win.
Of course, the reason, the political aspect of that, give the briefing, Grierson, as to why The Salesman is particularly urgent and in the news right now.
The filmmaker for The Salesman, who's Iranian, Oscar Farhadi, who won for A Separation a few years ago, was not going to be able to get into the country because of the Muslim ban. They weren't sure if he would be able to. Then Farhadi announced that whether or not there was an exception made for him, he was still not going to go. He released a statement essentially saying, I'm not going. I condemn this treatment of myself and people from these Muslim predominant countries. I think a lot of Oscar voters are going to vote for The Salesman as a way of saying we also strongly condemn the ban.
Okay, now we go to the best documentary feature. They are 13th. Fire at Sea, I Am Not Your Negro, Life Animated, and My Best Picture of 2016, OJ Made in America. For a long time, I have been under the assumption, not assumption, but I thought OJ Made in America was going to win this. Certainly, it is making the publicity rounds. Ezra Edelman is everywhere right now. It is impossible. He is on every television set. If you turn on your television, you will probably see Ezra Edelman right now. I still think it's going to win. I feel like there's a little bit of a late push from I Am Not Your Negro. That is, the movie is doing very well, actually. It's playing at two different theaters here in Athens, which is kind of an amazing thing. I still think OJ Made in America is going to win, if just because it's got such a promotion push behind it, but I can see I Am Not Your Negro sneaking in maybe in the back.
This, I think, is actually one of the best categories this year in terms of films. I think either 13th or I Am Not Your Negro could pull off an upset, but I think it's kind of a slight chance. I think OJ is going to win.
All right. Next is Best Animated Feature. They are Moana, The Red Turtle, Kubo and the Two Strings, My Life as a Zucchini, and Zootopia. It's funny, there was a stretch, remember that stretch in the middle of the year where everyone was telling me that Zootopia was one of the best movies of the year? There was like a little stretch right after it came out. I still think it's good. I think it's a fun movie. I think it's got a good message. I think it's on the good side. But I think everyone's kind of like, maybe I didn't see that on a lot of people's top 10 lists. I'll put it that way. All these people that are telling me how wonderful it was, they kind of backed off as the year goes along. I think that's going to win. I can see maybe a late push from Moana, which a lot of people really like. But I think Zootopia wins this.
Yeah, I still miss Finding Dory in this category, but I think Zootopia, which I think is perfectly fine, is going to win.
All right, next we go to Best Visual Effects. Doctor Strange, Kubo and the Two Strings, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Deepwater Horizon, and The Jungle Book. I think that I know there's going to be a temptation for some to go with Rogue One here, but I feel like the one that people were the most excited about, the one they liked the most, and the one you kind of got the most initial big praise for the special effects was The Jungle Book, and I think that'll win.
Yeah, I think so too. That talk about movies that got a lot of praise earlier in the year, Jungle Book, people were like, oh my God, that movie looks amazing. How did they do that? I think Jungle Book wins.
Yeah, I think you actually predicted that, actually. Chris, when we talked about The Jungle Book in the podcast, you're like, well, I'm going to bet that The Jungle Book is that movie that everyone says is their favorite movie of the year, so one of the best movies of the year so far, and it goes on no top 10 list at the end of the year. And you were exactly right.
I appreciate you noticing. Yes, I did note that myself. But yeah, but the effects, I mean, it's entirely green screen and how they all did that. Yeah, that's a great story. It made a ton of money. Yeah, I feel pretty confident Jungle Book's going to win that one.
We go to Best Sound Mixing, Hacksaw Ridge, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, Arrival, La La Land, and yes, 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. That one's not going to win. I feel like we've gone this far without a win for La La Land. Here is a win for La La Land.
Here is a win for La La Land.
Best Sound Editing, Arrival, La La Land, Deepwater Horizon, Hacksaw Ridge, and Sully. It's a bit of a push among some people for Hacksaw Ridge here. I'm still going to pick La La Land.
I'm actually going to go with Hacksaw Ridge, and the reason why is because I think this is one of those categories where they'll say, well, I mean, all those explosions and all the intensity of those action scenes, it's the type of thing I think where they look at it and think that's a really impressive job, whereas just the sound mixing, they'll think of that more for La La Land. So I actually think Hacksaw Ridge is going to win this.
All right. But I think those are your two. Pick one of those two. Again, as always, Grisha makes a better case than me because I'm hosting. I have to move on to the next one. Next is best song. They are How Far I'll Go from Moana, The Empty Chair from Jim the James Foley Story, Can't Stop the Feeling from Trolls. As my ears start bleeding just thinking and just saying those words. Audition, La La Land, the Fools Who Dream, and City of Stars from La La Land. My favorite of these songs actually is probably Audition, but I think City of Stars is going to win.
Yeah, a couple quick things. I think Audition is better than City of Stars, and I'm surprised that it's not going to win. My second thing is I really miss Drive It Like You Stole It. I wish they had been nominated from Sing Street. Number three, I'm a big Justin Timberlake fan, as we all know. I hate Can't Stop the Feeling. I think it's a terrible song. And number four, I do think City of Stars is going to win.
All right. By the way, if you guys have not heard Drive It Like You Stole It, just go. We discussed Sing Street a little bit on this podcast. To me, Drive It Like You Stole It is just a great pop song, first off, but also like thematically, it works perfectly in the movie. It's like, I think, the best sequence in the movie. So if you haven't seen Sing Street, go see it. And then you'll hear that song, be like, wait, how was that nominated? And that Justin Timberlake song was You American Monsters. All right. Next up is best score, Lion, Moonlight, Passengers, Jackie, and La La Land. I have to say, I would love to see Jackie win this. It will not. It will be La La Land.
I love the scores for Jackie and for Moonlight. I like the score for La La Land a lot, too. I think La La Land is going to win. I mean, if there's like an incredible upset across the board, La La Land is still going to win this category.
Absolutely. All right, next is Best Production Design. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Arrival, Passengers. Hail Caesar, and the one I'm predicting to win, La La Land.
Yeah, I think La La Land is going to win.
Next is Best Makeup and Hairstyling, A Man Called Ove, as you remember from our earlier foreign language film, Suicide Squad, and Star Trek Beyond. I'm picking Star Trek Beyond here because there is absolutely no way I'm going to think they're going to give Suicide Squad an Oscar.
Yeah, I think what hurts those other two movies is for Suicide Squad, it's Suicide Squad, and A Man Called Uwe. I don't think enough people have seen it. Star Trek Beyond actually did pretty decently and got good reviews. I think that's going to win.
All right, we're starting to get a little bit closer to the big stuff here. Next is Best Costume Design, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, Jackie, Allied, Florence Foster Jenkins, and I think this could be a little closer, but I'm going to pick the winner here again is La La Land.
I could see Jackie winning really easily, but the impression I just keep getting is that people are pretty cold to that movie, and it's a cold movie, so it makes some sense. I think La La Land is going to win.
All right, next we go to Best Film Editing, Arrival, Moonlight, Hell or High Water, Hacksaw Ridge, and once again, your winner is La La Land.
Yeah, I could see maybe an upset in this category, but not enough that I want to make an argument for it, so this will be Tom Cross's second Oscar win. He won for Whiplash as well.
All right, and now we have Best Cinematography. This is our last one before we get into the final eight. I think that's right. Yes, this is the last one before we get into the final eight. Best Cinematography, Lion, Arrival, Moonlight, Silence, and La La Land. Once again, rack it up for La La Land.
Yes. I don't see any of the other movies having a strong enough case to beat out La La Land. I think it's going to win.
All right, now we're to the final eight. We're to the final eight, Grierson. Are you ready? Are you prepared? Are you sitting down?
I am sitting down.
All right, fair enough. That's good to know. All right, the nominees for Best Adapted Screenplay. Best Adapted Screenplay, which is to say, we used to always know the rules for these things. They get a little bit more confused every year. But the nominees for Best Adapted Screenplay this year are Fences, August Wilson, Lion, Luke Davies, Arrival, Eric Hesser, Hidden Figures, Theodore Melfi and Allison Schroeder, and Moonlight, Barry Jenkins and Terrell Alvin McRaney. To me, Moonlight is considered by many the closest challenger to La La Land, and La La Land is not in this category. This seems like an ideal way to reward that movie rather than necessarily rewarding just an actor from it. I think it goes to Moonlight.
Yeah, I think the only person who has a chance of upsetting Moonlight is August Wilson for Fences. I mean, you know, he was a Tony winner, Pulitzer Prize winner. I think Moonlight's going to win.
All right, next to a Best Original Screenplay, Mike Mills, 20th Century Women. I always love, by the way, how irritated that R.E.M.'s Mike Mills always gets when people confuse him with this Mike Mills. It doesn't seem to bother the Mike Mills, the filmmaker, but it definitely bothers Mike Mills, the bassist. Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan, Hell or High Water, Taylor Sheridan, The Lobster, Yorgos Lanthimos, and Efthymis Philippou. Let's go with that. And La La Land, Damien Chazelle. I feel like there's a temptation to want to say Kenneth Lonergan's Manchester by the Sea feels very written, and I think people like really respond to the screenplay of that. I still feel like this is La La Land.
I'm going to be rooting for The Lobster in this category. I think Manchester by the Sea wins because I think, like with Moonlight, an adapted screenplay, this will be the chance to award this movie. So I think Manchester by the Sea is going to win this.
And I'm in full La La Land sweep mode. So these are both close. For the record, I didn't actually say what I would hope to win. Adapted screenplay would be Moonlight. And here, I would probably go, I'm probably rooting for The Lobster as well. I'm rooting for The Lobster or La La Land. Or Manchester by the Sea, La La Land. As long as Hell or High Water or 20th Century Women win, which they won't, those would be fine with me. So I think this is a tough one. Of the eight, I think you can make an argument this is probably the tightest race.
I would not make that argument.
You would not make that argument.
No, I think there's a tighter one. Yeah.
All right, but this is somewhat tight.
This is on the tighter side, I would say. Yes.
Fair enough. All right, so that one is. So there you go. So it's up to you. Whoever you think made the better case, Manchester by the Sea or La La Land in Best Original Screenplay. We go to Best Supporting Actor, probably the biggest lock on the board. Dev Patel in Lion, Michael Shannon in Nocturnal Animals, Lucas Hedges in Manchester by the Sea, Jeff Bridges in Hell or High Water, or your winner, Mahershala Ali in Moonlight.
Yes, Mr. Ali is going to win. I'm rooting for him. I'm actually actively looking forward to his Oscar speech.
Yes, it's going to be fun. And he certainly should have it prepared because he's won every award and everyone knows he's winning. And it's great because he's awesome. So no arguments there. To the Best Supporting Actress category, Michelle Williams in Manchester by the Sea, Naomi Harris in Moonlight, Nicole Kidman in Lion, Octavia Spencer in Hidden Figures, and Viola Davis in Fences. I feel like this is not quite as much of a lock as Mahershala Ali, but it is very close. I think this is clearly Viola Davis's category.
Yeah, I think she wins. I actually like all five of these nominees. I think the argument that Viola Davis is not really a supporting actress, that she's actually a lead actress in this, is a very valid argument, but that doesn't matter now. She's going to win.
All right. And that is, if I had to pick a favorite here, I think I might go with Naomi Harris. I think Viola Davis is great, but I think Naomi Harris is fantastic in Moonlight. But I guess with anytime people are really close in that, I'm probably just going to pick the person from Moonlight at this point. All right. Now we're getting to Best Director. Best director. Best directors are Barry Jenkins for Moonlight, Kenneth Lonergan for Manchester by the Sea, Denis Villeneuve for Arrival, a spectacularly bearded Mel Gibson for Hacksaw Ridge, and the person I would argue is going to win this category, I'm assuming this is not one of your ones that you find closer than this, that is Damien Chazelle for La La Land.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be a split year. Spoiler alert, I guess. I think Damien Chazelle is going to win. I'm, of course, rooting for Barry Jenkins, but yes, I think Mr. Chazelle is going to win.
It's funny, when you talk about speeches and what speeches you like to see, I like Damien Chazelle. I like La La Land a lot. I like Moonlight more. I wish Moonlight would win this. I agree with you, he's not going to. But man, Barry Jenkins would definitely give a better speech than Damien Chazelle. Question about that?
Yeah, we kind of skipped over this with the screenplay category because Barry Jenkins is going to win for that. Barry Jenkins, Viola Davis, and Mahershala Ali have given the best speeches across award season. And so I'm actually wanting them all to win just so I can hear them speak one more time. Barry Jenkins especially has just been fantastic, and it's been such a pleasure to hear him kind of talk about the movie. He's not going to get to do it in this category. He'll get to do it in screenplay.
All right, and now we go to Best Actress. Three more, everyone. I hope you've been writing these down, by the way. Not you, Grace. I know you don't have to write them down. You already know them. And plus, you can read your own story on NewRepublic.com this week. All right, Best Actress. Isabelle Huppert, or Huppert, as I prefer to call her, for Elle. Natalie Portman in Jackie. Meryl Streep in Florence Foster Jenkins. Ruth Negga from Loving. And your winner, Emma Stone from La La Land.
Yeah, I like Emma Stone a lot in La La Land. I'm rooting for Isabelle Huppert in Elle. But Emma Stone's going to win, and she's pretty great in it. And I have no qualms about her winning.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would begrudge Emma Stone winning this. I think if you unless you actively hate that movie, I think it's hard to argue that it's not. If this movie didn't win Best Picture, it didn't win Best Director, I still feel like she would be the one that they singled out from this movie.
Yeah, we talked about this when we did our Oscar nomination prediction podcast. The audition song clinched it for her, as far as I'm concerned, and she's going to win. I would be stunned if Miss Huppert won.
All right, now we go to what I believe you probably are referring to as the closest category, the Best Actor category. Your five nominees are Denzel Washington for Fences, Ryan Gosling for La La Land, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea, Andrew Garfield for Hacksaw Ridge, and Viggo Mortensen for Captain Fantastic. Now, I think this is clearly a two-horse race, Denzel Washington in Fences and Casey Affleck in Manchester by the Sea. On one hand, to make the case for each, Denzel Washington. The case for Casey Affleck is this was generally he was kind of the front runner for most of the run here. It's a way to, if you don't think this is going to win Best Screenplay, it's a way to reward that movie. It's certainly he's certainly one of the main things that people take away from this movie. He's kind of knocked people out. The case against him is, frankly, there's a lot of controversy around him, and I think that's been kind of tamped down. I don't think it's been tamped down. I think it's actually really risen up quite a bit. And I think that for if you don't know, he was accused of sexual harassment on the set of I'm Still Here, or I'm Not There, or I'm Still, whatever the name of that awful Joaquin Phoenix movie was. He was the director of that movie, and that's caused, I think, there's been quite a little bit of backlash against him about that. I think that does hurt him. The positives for Denzel Washington is it's Denzel Washington. Everybody loves Denzel Washington. Fences is kind of his project. He won a Tony for that role. He directed it, and it's a big performance. It's a very good performance. And the downside is that he has won two Oscars already. So that would be another downside for that. And another, for me, I would also argue this is actually not one of my favorite Denzel Washington performances. I know you like it more than I do, Grierson. If you're going to ask me to come down to a prediction, this one, I still am going to pick Casey Affleck. I think it's really, really close. I think you can't go wrong with either one. Well, you can go wrong with one of them's wrong. But I think my personal favorite of these five performances is Casey Affleck. And so maybe that swayed me a little bit, but that's my prediction.
Yeah, this is the toughest one. And you made the case very succinctly about why it's so neck and neck between the two of them. I usually don't bet on the person who's won in the past, especially if that person has won twice. But we're actually kind of in an era where that seems to have gone by the wayside. Meryl Streep won a third Oscar recently for a terrible movie, I will say, till my deathbed. Daniel Day-Lewis won a third Oscar recently. This performance for Denzel Washington is not as slam dunk as Lincoln was. Everybody knew that he was going to win for Lincoln. Meryl Streep was a legitimate surprise, I think, for that terrible movie. I just think that Denzel Washington is a big, huge star that Hollywood likes a lot. And a year removed from the Oscars so white controversy, this, if he wins, that would mean that three African-Americans win an acting Oscar. That's never happened before. I can see that being a pretty compelling case. You know, and just to say this really fast, Manchester by the Sea has actually made a lot of money. I mean, it's made like $48 million, so it's not like people haven't seen it. I just feel like Denzel Washington's performance is the type that people remember and respond to, or at least that voting block, more than maybe, say, Casey Affleck's, which is very good, but it's a smaller and more controlled performance in a way. It's a close one. It's a tough one. I am going to go with Denzel Washington, though.
All right. And remind you, of course, so in this idea, you have three African-American winners of the four major acting categories. And then, of course, Emma Stone, who, let's not forget, she's half Asian, right? From Aloha. That's the thing, right? She's not. She's not, actually. She just was cast as
that I have a defense for that, but it's not even worth getting into.
Yeah, it's not point. Worth getting into.
It's not worth getting into. No. I didn't say that that's the... Anyway, forget it.
Yes, don't get into it. I thought you just said you weren't getting it. Yes. Okay, so now we go to Best Picture. Here are your nine nominees for Best Picture. Your nine nominees are Arrival, Hacksaw Ridge, Fences, Hell or High Water, Lion, Manchester by the Sea, Moonlight, La La Land, and Hidden Figures. Now, I'm going to kind of break this down a little bit, Grierson, so get ready. It's about to get broken down.
You can break it down? All right, go ahead.
I think there are five obvious non-winners here. I think there's probably more than five obvious non-winners, but there are five I can easily sweep away. Arrival, Lion, Hacksaw Ridge, Fences, Hell or High Water. These movies are not winning Best Picture. You can agree with me on that, right, Kristen?
Yes.
Okay, so you've got four movies there. Now, I think for a long time here, La La Land, Moonlight, and Manchester by the Sea, I think for several months now, have generally been considered the three front runners. I think there was a time where you thought maybe La La Land was going to fall, but mostly I think La La Land has generally had that top run with the idea that Moonlight was the best one to be able to still knock it off. Now, that may still be true. It is also worth noting, however, that people freaking love Hidden Figures, man. Like, people love that movie. And I think it's a good movie, too. I don't mean to say that it's not. But I do think if there's been any movie that has had a finishing kick out of this, I think it would be Hidden Figures. I do not think Hidden Figures is going to win. However, yeah, I think it entered that top four of a possibility in the last couple of months. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Except for the fact that it's a good movie, yes. I would agree with all of that, yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, then we're not going to legislate that here. It's the Oscars. That's all been settled. but that said, I do not think it's going to win. I think you'd argue that it's past Manchester by the Sea in that top as a challenger. But I think, and that's an argument you can make or not make, but I think it's clearly either La La Land or Moonlight. And frankly, as much as I would like to see Moonlight make that push, and frankly, it's kind of amazing that Moonlight has gotten this close to where it is the most likely movie to knock off La La Land. Do you think that's true, right? Do you think if it's not La La Land, do you think it would be Moonlight?
I mean, I think it's either going to be Moonlight or Hidden Figures as the upset pick.
Right.
I agree. People love Hidden Figures, and that movie has a really nice bit of momentum. It has made more money than La La Land.
Than any other of the top movies, I believe.
Yeah, and so that's not necessarily like a major factor, but it helps. It definitely helps. I think those are now the top three that you're looking at, yeah.
But that said, I picked La La Land to win almost every other category. I think it's hard to argue it's not going to win tonight.
Yeah, my feeling about La La Land is, first of all, as you and I have said now for weeks, it's actually a really good movie, which also helps. But I know that there's been a lot of, especially on like in film Twitter and just in the critical consensus, there's been a lot of backlash and push against it. I am not convinced that stuff has reached the Academy and its voting members. I don't think they are wrestling with, is it racist? Does it get jazz correct? I don't think that they notice. I don't think that they care. I think that they like that movie. I think it's going to win.
Yes, I think so as well. So there are your picks. We only really have a couple disagreements there. So all told, I think that we're going to win. So remember, use this podcast to win your office pool. Wait until after you have won your office pool and everyone's like, again, hey, Tom, Dick, Harry, Frank, Betty, Veronica, Carolyn. There's probably some other names. How did you win that pool? No. Then you can tell them, go to the Grizzlies podcast, subscribe to us on iTunes, see us on SoundCloud and thenewrepublic.com. All right, so there are your Oscar picks. Take them and win. Now it is time for our first review, our only review of a new movie this week. That movie is The Great Wall.
Why are you here?
We came to trade.
You lie. You are thieves.
The Great Wall, as you may have heard, stars Matt Damon in, I believe it's the 12th century. It's in ye olden times as far as this movie is concerned, and it stars Matt Damon as a mercenary named William. William is kind of, you know, he's from Ireland, but he sort of travels from land to land fighting for whosoever army will pay him the most. As the movie begins, we find him in China, getting close to the Great Wall. What he discovers is that this sect called the Nameless Order is guarding the wall. And why are they guarding the wall? Because there are terrifying monsters on the other side. They're trying to smash through the Great Wall and destroy China. So Matt Damon joins up with the crew of the Nameless Order, including Andy Lau, to essentially fight all of these CG monsters. I highly recommend reading people like Scott Tobias, who have written very passionately about why this movie works and why this movie is, because it's gotten pretty bad reviews and it did not perform very well this weekend at the box office. It did pretty well in China, but has not done so well here. But Scott Tobias, writing at UpRocks, wrote a very convincing review, I thought, about why this film and its director, Zhang Yu, who is Chinese, is trying to integrate both Chinese and American culture, but more specifically, kind of preserve the idea of Chinese culture in a big, essentially Chinese Hollywood blockbuster co-production on like a mainstream level. It's really persuasive, and I really recommend reading the review. I don't quite feel it while watching it. I wish I had seen the movie that people like Scott are talking about, because I think that is a way forward for this type of thing. Because as I wrote for us for the New Republic, this is kind of what the future is going to look like. Hollywood more and more and more wants China's money for its international box office. And part of the way of doing that is really getting in bed with Chinese producers. This is the most expensive movie ever made in China. It was shot in China with a Chinese director, with Matt Damon as part of the cast. And obviously he's the main star, the lead of the movie. Before the movie came out months ago, there was a lot of talk about, oh, another white savior movie and like that. I didn't really find that to be much of a problem in this movie, to be honest, because Matt Damon is kind of part of the crew. He's not the guy who saved China all by himself, though I would argue that he is the star and he's the only person that gets like a character change, albeit one that's kind of rudimentary. My big problem with this movie is, frankly, it's like a lot of other big blockbusters that try to appeal to everyone and therefore no one, in that it's kind of big. It's sometimes exciting. It sure is pretty to look at sometimes. This is a filmmaker who did Hero and House of Flying Daggers and Raise the Red Lantern, so he knows his way around a camera, obviously. So making like a big action spectacle is kind of fun from him. But I just kind of didn't care very much, and I am not convinced that I will ever want to see Matt Damon in a ponytail in an action movie. It's a glib comment, but he just seems unconvincing, which is very surprising for a guy who has been in several Jason Bourne movies, so you think that he could be an action star. This movie is what I would call, in quotes, interesting, as opposed to actually good.
You know, I like it a little bit more than you did. And I think Damon's not good. I think that character is, I think he does the best he can. I don't think he's necessarily terrible. That you certainly look at him and you're like, man, this could be like a real groaner. He certainly looks terrible. He's trying to be like a taciturn. He's trying to be like an old Western gunslinger type of guy. And it doesn't quite work. But again, he's got like enough of a self-awareness about him in the way that he kind of takes on a role like this that it's not like a clunker. It's not like a massive like embarrassment. I think he's not great, but he's also aware of like, man, if I'm not careful, I could look completely ridiculous in this. And he doesn't. So I feel like that actually works. A little bit. Mostly, this movie looks fantastic. This movie is a glory to look at. And I have to say, I actually like a lot of the action stuff. I think the little demon, what are they called? Tootsies or whatever the hell they're called. Like the monsters that are attacking, it's really dopey. It makes no sense. There's some sort of, I think there is a nationalist message in the idea that like they are here out of individual greed and we are the collective that I guess these monsters are almost like beckoned or summoned by greed, and then they attack by greed. So I think that is, I think there's a frankly very Chinese like nationalist kind of message in that. I don't really care about that. I don't think the movie is convincing either one way or the other than that. I just think those things are actually kind of cool, and some of those action sequences look really fun. There's a really great one where they kind of run through the stained glass building and they're being chased and they have to run up these stairs that looks awesome. Like, it's a really fun action sequence. The movie is kind of ridiculous. It's really, really dopey. Like, really dopey. But I have to say, most big action movies are really dopey. Like, the Michael Bay movies are really dopey. But this movie has a really dopey kind of good cheer, where that just has a really dopey cretinism. And I think this is a movie that is sincere and kind of definitely very silly. But in its individuals, no, there are many scenes where I would watch, absolutely would be eager to watch again. Most of them, I would argue all of them, have no talking in them and no characters in them. But there are some scenes in this movie that you can tell that they threw 150, however many million dollars at with a terrific filmmaker to make some pretty awesome scenes. So like, I think the movie doesn't hold up on the whole very well at all. And it's just definitely one of those movies that if you give it a recommendation, as I think I'm going to, there's going to be a lot of moments that will be like, but wait, what about this? And this is really stupid. And wait, you like this? No, I do not endorse everything in this movie, but I do think the action sequence are enough for me to really to kind of push me over the edge.
I love the sequence where William jumps off the wall and has to go into the thick fog and hear the whistling to see when those critters are coming to eat him. I think that's really good. The stained glass sequence I like fine. I think it's good. I do think there's just too much CG in this. I don't think that he figures out exactly how to make that not like every other like big CG action sequence. I'm not going to ask you to defend things in the movie because you just said you're not going to. But there is a lot of goofy, dopey, and like all the character stuff is pretty dumb. It's pretty dumb you've got like Tony Gilroy and other screenwriters working on this, and it feels like you have all these different writers working on a movie that there are good action sequences. I just don't think there's enough to connect those in a way where I really cared what I was watching.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I do get that. But, you know, this movie is made for spectacle. I like some of the CG. I actually like those little monsters. I think they're certainly, you can make an argument that some of those monsters actually have better character development than most of the characters in the movie. I think that the idea of their collective is kind of interesting. And the way that they are convincingly ferocious, I will put it that way. And there are CGI things that look bad, and I don't think he's great at any integrating it all that well. I think particularly the big climactic sequence, it feels a little like that World War Z problem where it's like, okay, I know this is meant to be of scale and overwhelming, but it just looks fake. Like it has a little bit of that problem. But I like them individually. I think that they're scary. Like, I think there is an element of scary of kind of they're a little bit more interesting than your traditional kind of Like, I'll take these guys over whatever that thing is at the end of Super 8, like 100 times and 10 times over. And I feel like there's a lot of stuff like that. Like look at, like, the monsters in Hollywood movies now. They all kind of look like the Cloverfield guy. And these are a little bit different. Like, these are kind of, they're ferocious and scary in a way that I thought really worked they're very convincing foes. They're definitely formidable opponents.
I forget who wrote this on Twitter, so I can't give the person proper credit, but whoever wrote that, I just saw the Edge of Tomorrow fan fiction and it was awesome. To me, the Edge of Tomorrow bad guys were a better version of a collective scary thing, though these critters have two scary things going for them. Number one, they've got huge-ass teeth, which are always effective. And then number two, their eyes are in a weird place in their body, which I actually think is actually the most unsettling about the character, because it's like they look at you from the sides as opposed to, like, straight on, which I think is kind of interesting. And also, we determine that you have to stab them in the eyes. That helps defeat them. So
handily, Matt Damon's really good with a bow and arrow, so that helps.
Yes. Well, you're making my case for me. So
Do you want to touch on, just briefly before we kind of wrap up on this? I have to say, you brought up the white savior thing, and again, I understand the arguments. I get it. Like, I get it. It's a trope of film history that I think in recent years there has been a understandable backlash against, and frankly, movement away from that. You're going to have a hard time convincing me that this movie, completely financed by the Chinese government and is a white savior movie, because frankly, Matt Damon is the one that learns, if anything, he learns that his ways are wrong. He learns that almost the American way, the idea that he is this lone Western taciturn guy that doesn't join anything. If anything, he's the one that learns that is wrong. And in fact, by everyone sacrificing for the greater whole, that is actually the right way to go. He's nobody's savior in this movie. He becomes part of the team, which again is a type of message I suspect the Chinese government was very eager to promote.
I would agree with that. I would also say, though, that all of the characters are so poorly drawn that it's nobody's really saving anybody in this movie. But yes, I do think that the initial kind of concern was premature, put it that way.
But to be fair, if you were to watch those little ads, I mean, you know, the ads were just, and you're like, wait, so Matt Damon's on the Great Wall? Like, why is Matt Damon on the Great Wall saving all these Chinese people? Like, I understand why that happened. I think once you've seen the movie, you're like, oh, well, that's A, that's not really right. B, why am I getting so worked up about this?
Yeah, no, B is my argument. Why get worked up about it? Because the movie's kind of dumb. I will say, though, Matt Damon is conveniently the most kick-ass hero of the movie. He's not alone as being a kick-ass hero, but he is the one guy who's like, oh, so I just have to do this? No problem. Pew, pew, pew. Like, he just, that was the sound of a bow and arrow, faithful listeners, in case you're wondering what I was doing there. So that's a little whatever. Okay, enough. Enough of the Great Wall. So that's,
what'd you give it?
I gave it a C.
Yeah, I'm a B minus. I'm a B minus on the Great Wall. I am team Scott Tobias on this one, which is to say, I gave it a just barely over the not so great wall of to make it into B minus land. So that is the Great Wall, this movie that I just gave a positive review for, that I'm almost certain will never show up in a Grierson and Leach podcast ever again. Now it is time for our reboot section. Our reboot movie is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
If adventure has a name, it must be Indiana Jones. From Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
You don't believe me. You will, Dr. Jones.
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out in 1984. It is famously the first ever PG-13 movie. It was given that rating because there is a scene where a man has his heart ripped out of his chest. And some people, I think understandably, said, wow, should someone who is 8 see this? And so the answer turned out to perhaps be no. Brief moment, sideline on that idea. I took my children to see the Lego Batman movie. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. But because my local theater is not the best local theater, they had accidentally put the new Underworld movie on there, the scary vampire movie. So we watched all of these R-rated trailers, confused, and then all of a sudden, there are vampires attacking a ski lift or something. So be careful of your local theater. Your 2-year-old will be terrified of a vampire movie when he thinks he's watching the Lego Batman movie. Anyway, back to the Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Of course, it is the second of the Indiana Jones movies directed by Steven Spielberg. This one is a story by George Lucas. You can sort of tell, but we'll get into that in a moment. This is, we find Indy, this time the movie starts where he is in Shanghai, but he ends up with Short Round. We'll probably talk about Short Round a little bit in this podcast. Short Round and a woman named Willie Scott, played by the future Steven Spielberg, Ms. Steven Spielberg, Kate Capshaw. She's a lounge singer who they end up all kind of on this plane together. The plane crashes because the people in Shanghai are trying to kill Indiana Jones. The plane crashes and he ends up in this. Basically, he comes across these villagers who all of their children have been taken from them. And he, as he investigates this, by the way, we are more than halfway into the movie before we meet the villain, who is the infamous Molaram, the aforementioned Molaram Sudaram. He is the leader of these villagers who will sacrifice people to get these stones. And of course, they're always trying to get stuff that Indiana Jones is trying to get for fame and fortune, as he says, so they can rule the world. So there is Indiana Jones. There's a lot to dig into with this movie. Like, you know, there are some people like Roger Ebert famously who loved this movie. I think he may even said that he liked it as much, if not more, than Raiders of the Lost Ark. He has famous, this is the bruised forearm movie. If you like Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you know, Grierson and I did a ranking of the top Steven Spielberg movies for Vulture a couple years ago, and actually had Raiders of the Lost Ark as the best Steven Spielberg movie. I still think that's right, and I think watching this movie is a pretty example of why, of just how great a job he did in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and just how many mistakes he avoids from that movie that does not avoid in this movie. This movie has several things wrong. I want to talk about what's great about it first. The last half hour is fantastic. I think that is what Ebert was talking about when he talked about the bruised forearm movie. I think the roller coaster ride is amazing. I think when he is on the bridge and being attacked by both sides, that is fantastic. Those are some really vintage. Those action sequences could hold up in some of the great, like the chase in Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the boulder, and some of these great set pieces from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Those, I think, could hold up. What doesn't hold up, listen, there are all sorts of cultural sensitivities issues that we can certainly get into this, starting with Short Round and going into all sorts of these exotic, weird people that's kind of going on. I think all of those things are fair and I think are justified. I think if there's a major problem in addition to that, this movie, Kate Capshaw is not very good. Like, I'm sorry. I mean, no offense to you. I'm sure you've had a wonderful life together, and I'm sure she's a wonderful person, but that is a very lame character. Her job in this movie is to constantly get into trouble, to constantly complain about, oh, I'm just this. There are bugs. There are gross food. Why don't want to be here? Why are you such a jerk? It is an incredibly grating character, to say the very least, and she is around the whole time. There's still some vintage Spielberg stuff in this. There's even those little great cutaways where, again, another good action sequence where they're on this kind of like conveyor belt, and Indiana Jones, after he's been like sharked back into life after becoming evil Indiana Jones, which is kind of fun actually for a moment, where there is a moment where this big strong man has a sledgehammer and is about to hit it, but then he accidentally flips it back over his head, and there's a cut to someone getting bonked on the top of the head. Just like a vintage, awesome, one of my favorite things about Spielberg is he had this really high adrenaline action sequence and just have enough confidence as a filmmaker. The most famous example of this is the objects in the mirror are closer than appear moment in Jurassic Park. He has enough confidence as a filmmaker to just make a really great sight gag and then be like, oh yeah, right, I'm completely losing my mind because this sequence is so great. I love that about him. There's a lot of little moments right there. I'm not sure I understand Molaram's plan ultimately to get them, but, and I will say another credit to this movie, it is not just a rehash of the first movie. it actually goes in a different direction. Unfortunately, I don't know if I loved all of those directions. There's still a lot of great stuff in this movie, but I have to say, when we did our Spielberg's ranking, we may have overrated this a little bit.
Where do we rank it? I'm trying to, I meant to look this up.
I think we had it as the second best Indiana Jones movie, and I'm not sure I'd put it above Last Crusade.
I would have to see Last Crusade again. We both agree it's better than Crystal Skull, though, right?
Yes, yes. No, it is worth noting, by the way, though. I'd like to mention this very briefly. The nuke the fridge scene, which is the one that everyone comes up in as the one that they hate at Crystal Skull, I have to say, is the lifeboat sequence at the beginning of this movie any less ridiculous than that? Where, like, the lifeboat comes, they literally just land on a plane, and the lifeboat that is an inflatable raft, and it just lands perfectly and then falls off this cliff and lands perfectly there. That sequence is just as ridiculous as the nuke the fridge sequence.
No, I'm pretty sure that's realistic. I think that's how that would work. I had not seen this movie in quite some time, and I was pretty prepared for, I had my problematic goggles on in preparation for this. There is not one thing that is wrong about this movie that I would disagree with that you would bring up. I had a pretty fun time watching this, I had to say. I never say this during our reboots, but I'm going to say it for this movie. I was amazed that, 30 years later? Because I remember seeing this movie when it came out. 30 years later, the sequence where Indiana Jones gets turned into evil Indiana Jones still freaks me out to the core. And it's amazing because you grow out of most of the things that freaked you out as a kid. It was amazing to actually like watch myself watching it now going, God, like young Tim is right here right now. Like there is something that is so, what's also interesting about this movie just in general is not just the things that he does differently than he does in Raiders Lost Ark. The tonal shift in this movie is kind of like almost will create vertigo because the first half is really like, oh, I thought he had learned the lesson from 1941 that he can't do comedy. Like, did he not learn that lesson? And the first half is really broad and really goofy. I still think the sequence in Shanghai is pretty well done, even though it does get into really stupid slapsticky kind of action stuff. And then the second half is incredibly dark. It's incredibly dark. And like, as you said, with Ebert, with the bruised arm stuff in the second half, it's like, it's sort of shocking that he kind of combined these two movies. The second half wins me over, though, I have to say. I still think it's pretty damn effective. Just to correct one quick thing, this movie was actually rated PG, but it created PG-13.
Oh, sorry. Correct.
Because people were like, holy shit, this is way too scary for my kid. And so what I think is fascinating about watching this movie now is I agree everything. The Kate Capshaw is just so terrible. It just... so incredible. And to quote the Ebert review again, the part I always remember from that review is him describing the sequence when they have their little flirtatious back and forth between their rooms. And I think Ebert says, like, that's when you go to the bathroom or go get some popcorn. That sequence actually is not too terrible, I have to say. But I think I'm not sure if it's the performance so much as the way it's pitched, which is like, She's supposed to be the shrill girl who can't hang out with the boys. That's basically what that character is. But she's like hot and pretty, so it's okay that she's hanging around. But I felt like the overall like roller coaster effect of this movie, especially for the fact that it's a prequel, which is also I think worth pointing out. George Lucas did not want to make another movie about Nazis. So he was like, well, what am I going to do? What if we go back in time and do a prequel and kind of created, it wasn't the first prequel ever, but it kind of created the prequel universe that he would then use for those little Star Wars movies that he would do later. But for a movie that's actually a prequel, I just think it does a pretty good job of suspending your disbelief enough about how is Indiana Jones going to get out of this. I agree that I'm not sure what the bad guy's plans are other than grab hearts. That seems to be their idea. Yes. They're going to grab hearts, be jerks to little kids, and steal stones. That seems to be their entire plan. But it creates such a forward momentum that I did get swept up in it. You know, you mentioned the whole like train chase, which is still really good. That bridge sequence, I think, is pretty great too. I think it's actually really well done. I agree that this is a more, to the point that you alluded to, this movie is a lot more cartoony. It's a lot more campy already. And I think this is actually a bigger problem in Last Crusade. They're already kind of getting the idea that like, hey, Indiana Jones is sort of a funny concept, right? Raiders of the Lost Ark really doesn't do that. After that, they start doing that. I think that's why the series starts to kind of fall apart. That all being said, I love it when the bad guys get in this movie because I absolutely hate these people. And so there is a satisfaction in them actually getting it in the end. Again, I mean, I was actually thinking as you were describing your feelings about watching The Great Wall that that movie and this movie are kind of perfectly aligned because there's a lot of stuff where you're like, yeah, I know, but I couldn't help it. I kind of had a blast watching this.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to be, I don't mean to be as harsh on that as I said, because I think, to me, certainly the last half hour, that just everything, once the movie, it just takes a really long time to get going. It takes a really long, not that it's so much slow, but like, I don't really think the little kind of Busby Berkeley number is great, I have to say. I don't think that's great. I don't think it, I really think until he turns into bad, until really Mola Ram does that sacrifice and then turns him into bad Indy, that's when the movie, like, I really feel like the whole thing up to that is a time to go get popcorn. I think that's your popcorn time. I don't think there's really a lot to recommend it. But after that, I think it's terrific. And it is a darker tone. But even the darker tone stuff is a little dialed up. You're so right about Mean Indy, by the way. I don't know if I had that same scare thing as a kid, but it is disorienting to see Mean Indiana Jones.
Yeah, for me specifically, there's two moments. One where he's getting whipped and Short Round's getting whipped, and then they pour that juice down him again. That's really upsetting. And then when he's actually on that bed with all of the candles and he starts having the freak out, it's legitimately intense, and the movie does not set you up properly in its first half that's going to happen. And I think that's what's so jarring to the movie's credit. It's so upsetting. We're like, wait, weren't they like doing dumb dance numbers where Harrison Ford's running around trying to grab a potion or an antidote or something? By the way, that's the strongest glass vial, I think, in cinema history. Yes. Whoever manufactured that, they're going to make a million, I think. So when it changes, it's like you're not prepared. You are, you know, they kind of set you up with like the snake surprise and other things where it's like gross and scary and freaky and like that. But you kind of don't know what you're getting yourself into in that second half. Do you want to talk about Short Round? Do you want to?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, this always has to be said. I am a white guy. I don't feel like I have much validity in my opinion of saying, oh, it's not that bad. But that being said, going into it this time, I was sort of ready to cringe the entire time. I you know, if there's a scale from like 1 to 10 of this stuff, it was more of a 5. Than a 10, which I was sort of anticipating, which again is not to say, oh, people,
it's fine.
People have been wrong about this for 3 decades. Let me, as a white person, explain that to you. But I will say that I didn't think it was quite as terrible. And the one thing I think that maybe partly redeems it, which I think actually, you know, I don't think this is too far of a leap. I think it actually creates an idea of giving him, meaning Indiana Jones, giving him a son-like character in a way that I think actually works for that movie. It works in terms of like the bond that the two of them have in the film, but also it connects this idea of all the kids being stolen and this idea of Indiana Jones kind of being this father who's sort of rescuing them. Is he a white savior? Maybe we'll get to that in a second. It didn't bother me, I guess is the point. It did not bother me as much as I feared it was going to.
Yeah, if anything, I mean, I think I'm a little bit more about just, it's in the moments, it's just hard. Like, because you've just seen, I'll put it this way, it's worse in other 80s movies. I think that's probably fair to say. I can name like 10 movies off the top of my head where there are an Asian stereotype that is a lot worse than Short Round. But I still don't think Short Round is great. Also, what is not great if we're playing our problematic game? I mean, this is not actually what Indian culture is like. They don't eat monkey brains. They don't eat apple soup.
Yeah, and this is absolutely not a valid defense. But I will say, while watching it, it's so ridiculous that there was a part of me that went, "Well, nobody believes this, right? Like, this is like a." This is like an overblown kind of thing, but again, it speaks to the idea of not even thinking about how other cultures would want to be represented or yes. actually representing those cultures in an accurate. It feels like I realized I wish I had gone back and seen if Spielberg ever talked about this. It feels like a movie idea about what other cultures are like. I wish it was more of a parody of like. Let's do all of these, like, essentially, like, oonga boonga, like, stereotypes and, like, make fun of it. It doesn't, like, the movie does not do that.
This is a general problem with making movies that are self-consciously throwbacks.
Right.
Is that you're throwing back to a time where, as bad as the 80s were, try the 40s, man. And I think that's part of the problem is when you're doing a movie that is kind of doing the Gunga Din, for example, throwback, you're throwing back to a time that maybe it's best ultimately some of those attitudes to be moved on from. And I think so that way where you can look at people in the 40s and be like, man, that's pretty bad. You think of the 80s, be like, okay, you have to, like, there needs to be a spin on those things, a self-awareness of that I'm not sure this movie necessarily has.
No, and I would agree with that. Yeah. I mean, the monkey brain thing is just so stupid. It's so incredibly dumb. It's like, did they think this was like a, they must've thought there was like a laugh line, right? Like they had to think like a funny, like gross out. Cause the whole thing is just so that Kate Capshaw can do like the,
more of that.
Ooh, yeah. Ooh. And then pass out and stuff like that.
Yeah. She is very bad in this movie. I think it's a bad character. I don't think you can entirely blame her, but like, I will say Indiana Jones has had better company in his movies before.
He has. I will say, and I'd be now curious to go back and watch Last Crusade. I think the thing that I like about this more than Last Crusade is Last Crusade feels a little bit like, okay, we're going to just play it straight now. And it's a little more staid than this movie, which is like nutsy, insane, and way off, like goes off the rails and stuff like that. I have to say that watching this movie, I thought, like you said, Raiders of the Lost Ark is kind of a miracle in a way. Like, you have to get that tone just right, and they did get it just right. And everything after that, they just couldn't figure out. I think what is interesting about this franchise, it to me has always felt like Spielberg going, sure, George, I'll do another one of those. It feels like he is doing it for his friend. And I think that, you know, some of the action sequences in this movie actually made me think of like some of the stuff in Minority Report and stuff that he's done in more recent years. Like, there's a connection in terms of like how witty the action sequences are. But it still feels like saying that Spielberg is kind of going like, yeah, I could do that. That's fine. You know, it's not stuff I look at and think that's the best of what he can do.
Yes. But I will say that then to close out on this, it is still just always a pleasure to watch Harrison Ford in this role, particularly as young Harrison Ford. Like, again, there's always this idea. There's always this discussion of Hollywood's always looking for a Harrison Ford type. It's amazing. It always seems to be white guys. Like, but that Harrison Ford, like, rugged charisma of that mid-70s up until when did Harrison Ford start getting old, start to feel like grizzled, presumed innocent, is that when we started treating him as the non-matinee idol and more of an adult?
Well, I mean, I was thinking about The Fugitive, but
presumed innocent was before that.
You know, I mean, he'd done Mosquito Coast, which any chance I have, any opportunity I have to say, he is so great in that movie, and that movie is so fantastic and so underrated. I mean, he's so fantastic, so good in that movie. And that was like the late 80s. So, you know, I mean, there was definitely that period in the late 80s where he's like, hey, I'm an actor. And he did like Frenzy, right? Yeah, the Roman Polanski movie, and then Mosquito Coast and stuff like that. So, I am in all seriousness, after that plane crash, I'm just so glad, or that plane mishap he had. I miss this Harrison Ford too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And remember, I loved him. For the record, if you remember, I was the for Force Awakens, when everyone was trying to do the Stallone in Creed. I mean, they did successfully. There was almost an upset they didn't win. I felt like if you were going to have a harkback great performance, I feel like he's great in Force Awakens, because it feels like a little flash of that back a little bit, that even when he's doing action roles now. I bet he's not good in the Blade Runner reboot. Like, he doesn't seem like the thing with Force Awakens is it felt like he kind of rouses himself a little bit from that like studied grumpiness that you kind of see from him now. You saw him like almost, I think Mike Ryan, our friend of ours at Up Rocks, wrote one thing I thought was really smart about this, was the idea that like the role. Him in Force Awakens felt like him making his peace with the Han Solo thing that he's kind of complained about for a long time and accepting that a little bit. I'm not sure that'll happen in Blade Runner. I'm not sure that happened in the last Indiana Jones movie, to be honest. So that was a flash of that, but it's still the real thing to see it in this moment. It's like Chris Pratt, you're not there yet, man. I'm sorry, but you're just not there yet.
Yeah. I mean, with Blade Runner, I'm really hoping that he is like, it's almost like an Apocalypse Now kind of thing where he's found at the end. Because my impression is that Ryan Gosling's character is searching for him. So I'm hoping that's like the extent of the movie is him searching and then at the end finding him. Because I do kind of worry about, though I have to say, and then we'll let this go, it seems like Harrison Ford has a better relationship with Blade Runner than he does Star Wars in particular. Like, he doesn't seem so contemptuous of his fame connected to it, where I think with Blade Runner, I think he feels like that was good and it didn't get enough attention and people kind of missed the boat on it. So maybe he'll have a different relationship in terms of playing it. But if you tell me there's a new Blade Runner, I think, oh, interesting. If you tell me Harrison Ford's in it, I'm like, oh, okay.
It's the
Jimmy Kimmel of cameos for that movie. Yes.
Okay, well, that is Indiana Jones the Temple of Doom. I think a spirited discussion about a movie that I think there's a lot of stuff to talk about. All right, Grayson, next week we only have one new movie coming out that we're going to be discussing. We will be discussing Get Out, written and directed by Jordan Peele of Key and Peele, and starring Danielle Kaluuya. Is that right, Grayson?
Maybe.
Go with yes. Yes, that's good. Allison Williams, Bradley Whitford, Catherine Keener, excuse me, Keith Stanfield from Atlanta, which I'm very excited about, Caleb Landry Jones. A horror comedy, mostly horror. Very excited to see that. We'll be discussing that week. I'll be reviewing that for The New Republic as well. And then we have two reboot sections next week. Very exciting, very uplifting movies, by the way. You're definitely gonna come away feeling good about humanity. Our first reboot movie is 1995's Seven, directed by David Fincher, starring Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Spacey. Sorry to spoil it. Kevin Spacey's in that movie. Gwyneth Paltrow. It's an uplifting movie. It is Seven. We've discussed a David Fincher movie already on this. So it's amazing to me the number of requests we've gotten for David Fincher's movies, actually, which I think is maybe a pretty good sign. But that's the lighthearted comedy.
Yeah. please, Will, tell me that the next reboot movie is a little lighter.
It is. It is 1978's The Deer Hunter, directed by Michael Cimino, starring Robert De Niro, Christopher Walken, Meryl Streep, John Cazale. John Savage is about very long, 3-hour-plus movie about the Vietnam War and the aftermath. George Zunda, I forget that George Zunda was in this as well. The Deer Hunter, won Best Picture. Deer Hunter won Best Picture, and I think what happened with Heaven's Gate a few years after that, I think has made people not think of The Deer Hunter as vividly as perhaps they would have thought they would have in 1979. But we're going to talk about, to make us both happy and smiling in this wonderful world. It's been a while since I saw The Deer Hunter. Obviously, the stuff that everyone remembers for The Deer Hunter. I also remember they all joke about a lot of Rolling Rock. That might mean I'm just drinking too much at the last time that I saw The Deer Hunter. But yes, an uplifting show next week. Get Out, Seven, and The Deer Hunter.
I'm glad that product placement worked after all those years, by the way, on you for Rolling
finally,
Rock.
It's paying off. Finally for paying off. I'm sure Rolling Rock was like, oh, awesome. Drink away the horrors and pain of Vietnam with our with our beer. All right, so everyone, enjoy the Oscars this week. Enjoy the Academy Awards. Enjoy. Let us know. We're probably not going to do an Oscar post show. So if you have any thoughts, I think I'm going to tweet out. I'm not a heavy live tweeter. I'm not. It's not really what I do. But I thought I might give it a shot for this. So check out Grierson Leach during the show. All the good tweets will be by me. All the ones that fall flat are the ones that I let Grierson do.
For the record, I'm not going to live tweet, so I'm...
Yeah, you just know the bad ones are Grierson.
I'm not tweeting. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, he's saying that now. But then if there's a good one, he's going to claim it.
I would not do that.
All right, Grierson, have a great week. Enjoy the Oscars. Do you remember a time we went to Oscar parties? It's been a while since I've been to an Oscar party.
Yes. If the question is, do I remember them? Yes, I do. Yes, Your Honor, I do remember that. I haven't gone to one in a while. I may actually have family in town, so I may watch it with them, or I may just DVR it and watch it later. So,
well, you can you out there can at least stay up for it.
Yes.
I'm gonna do my best. It gets harder and harder every year. All right, everyone, have a great week. We will be back next week with Get Out.
How many exclamation marks is that?
I don't know. The Deer Hunter and Seven. Have a great
Seven!
Week. Seven! Seven. I don't know if I'm going to understand what's going on. I haven't seen the first six. I think it's probably time to close it. See you, Grierson.
Bye.
Bye. My mind makes a rattle from the stick on the ground. And I won't let the storm shoot me down. And if I want to stop being myself for a while, then I don't want to do it alone. You can be Luke Skywalker.